This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show three of the hosts of the Trauma Behind the Badge podcast and members of the Survive First family, Doug Monda, Raul Rives, and Chris Fields. Now, each of these gentlemen have been on the show individually, but I wanted to get them together as a group. We've got two members of law enforcement and a firefighter offering a very unique perspective on all things first responder. So we discuss a host of topics, from the recruitment crisis to organizational betrayal and everything in between. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So that being said, I welcome back onto the show Doug, Chris, and Raul. Enjoy. Well, Doug, Chris, and Raul, I want to start by saying, firstly, thank you all for coming back to the Behind the Shield podcast. I can't remember if it was Doug or Chris that was the first of you guys that was on. I know Raul was the most recent one we did in his home.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a long time now, I've been thinking, you guys do your podcast together all the time. I need to get you on collectively as guests on the Behind the Shield podcast so we can put all these minds together. So I want to start simply by welcoming you back into the Behind the Shield podcast.
No, great to be back.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
So for people listening, again, each of you has already done your own episode. So, you know, search that on the Behind the Shield podcast if you want to hear the full conversation and the full stories. But let's just give an overview, starting with you, Doug. Give me, you know, people listening, an overview of your career, you know, any highs and lows that you want to hit. And then, you know, obviously then we'll dive into some of the topics that we're talking about today.
Yeah, just a little recap. I'm a retired police officer out of Central Florida. Spent most of my career on a SWAT team. Drugs and guns was my specialty. Spent most of my career chasing guns and drug dealers, things like that. Over the course of my career, I encountered a lot of traumatic events, some nationally known, and it led me down a long journey, dark dark journey down a dark road, and I didn't do so well when I was on that dark road, and I didn't take care of myself the way I should have mentally. I was really good at taking care of myself physically, but just not mentally. And I ultimately attempted to take my life back in 2013 and then again in 2015. And it kind of opened the door for me to get into this mental health world. Back then, there really wasn't a whole lot of people doing what we do and what I started to do. And here I am today, over 10 years later, still traveling around the country, speaking at conferences, helping first responders get the care that they need. And I'm still currently the president and founder of the Survive First Foundation. That's kind of where I'm at today, 2025. Yep. Did I get the year right?
You did. You did indeed. All right. Well, let's go to Chris then. Chris Fields.
Yeah, Chris Fields, retired Oklahoma City Fire Department, 31 years, 7 months, and 16 days to be exact, service. Been retired 8 years. Yeah, just finished my 8th year of retirement. I want to keep sticking it to the state as long as I can and drawing that check. And I got into the mental health because I'm like kind of like Doug, from my own struggles. I get my platform and I get the chance to speak and be associated with these guys and you, James, because of the Oklahoma City bombing and a photo I was captured in. And I know that because nobody's going to just have Chris Fields, a retired Oklahoma City firefighter, come speak. And I know that, but that's where I get my platform. But to me, it's all about the cumulative trauma of the, 32 year career. And that's the message that, you know, I want to get out. And when I get to go speak and travel and do things, I could probably be up there for 5 minutes and just say, hey, don't wait until the wheels fall off before you reach out for help and be done. Because that's mainly, I think that's all of our goal is to have people not go down the road, you know, that we went down. And what's the old saying about, you know, going upstream and catching people before they, you know, get in the river. And that's kind of what I am. And I know suicide is the ultimate thing we want to shut down, but I tell people, I got a little soapbox. I was out in LA last week, got up on a soapbox about, especially firefighters. We always want to talk about this family, these brotherhood and the sisterhood. And well, if we're really, let's step up like we should, then if we're really going to call these people our brothers and sisters and take care of them, you know, no matter what the issue is with them, whether it's on the job injury, cancer, or mental health stuff. And so it's just kind of my passion now that to be involved with it. And I'm honored to be involved with it, and especially with these guys.
Absolutely. All right, Raul Rivas.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on first, James. I appreciate it. I can't tell you enough. Honored and humbled that you asked. So, yeah, Raul Rivas, also a police officer, retired now. I'm old, so retired from the Orlando Police Department. Did 26 years there, 28 total in law enforcement. Like Chris said, my platform, reason I get to kind of come speak with these heroes, these national heroes, is I was involved in the pretty big incident, the Pulse nightclub incident that happened back in 2016. And I too, like all of us, I had my mental health journey afterwards. Not like Chris just said again, I'm stealing everything from Chris, but like he said, it wasn't just the incident. It was the cumulative stuff that happened before the incident. And it took a lot of work for me to realize that, that's what it was. So in that journey and after that journey, I got hooked up with these guys, and now I'm part of Survive First. I'm on the board for Survive First. And I basically commit my time to making sure that first responders get the help that they need, educate them that there is help out there. and just making sure that they know that we're here for them and that we have a network. We have people around the country. So when you call, no matter where you're at, no matter where you're from, we know somebody that can help you, get you the help you need. So that's kind of what I do now.
Fantastic. Well, we were having a quick kind of roundtable before we hit record of some topics that I think are pertinent because, as Doug said, I mean, he's been in, you know, the what next space, you know, when it comes to the mental health of our first responders for a decade now. This podcast is almost 9 years old. So the conversations that we were having early on, you know, I think they've evolved and there's some amazing topics that you guys threw out there. The one that I think is one of the least discussed, apart from sleep deprivation, which is my dead horse that I flog on a daily basis, is organizational betrayal, organizational stress, and we'll unpack, you know, some of these titles. But whether it is, you know, a police officer, a first responder who did everything right and then got thrown under the bus from political side, or whether it's just simply a passionate, aggressive first responder who wants to do the right thing and they're in a toxic culture where they tell them to sit down, shut up, you're making us look bad. I see that being one of the, you know, least discussed pieces of the pie when it comes to overall mental health. So, Chris, you were the first person that threw that in the ring. So let's start with you. Talk to me about, you know, the evolution of this being a big part of the puzzle that we need to acknowledge.
As far as the organizational,
yes,
what we call distrust, betrayal, or what, I can't remember the word Doug used, but it was better. But yeah, and like I said, it was one of those things that I never really, I didn't experience it personally. You know, I know some people that have, and I'm like Raul said earlier too, it's been going on for probably years. We just didn't ever have a name for it. You know, back then we'd say it was us against them, or the blue shirts against the white shirts, or that, you know, that was just kind of the, it was just kind of something you expected to, you know, always think they didn't have your best interest, you know, on their radar. But I tell you, I've been in this, I call it a game sometimes, for a while, I've seen it more and more. And one specific example real quick, and I won't give the city, and I won't give names and all that, but, and this isn't anything against the IFF Center of Excellence either. They had nothing to do with this, but I know of a local union that was going to help a firefighter get treatment. He came forward. The city had a policy and said, if you'll come to us and say you need help, your first 30 days, 60 days, first time is personal leave. You know, you don't have to burn time, you don't, all that. Now, if you wait until you've got a DUI or beat your wife or domestic, whatever, if you wait till then, it's on your dime, which I kind of like that. Well, guy comes forward, union's going to step up and get him there, pay for his airfare, do some stuff. And he told him what facility he wanted to go to because he trusted this place. Well, it wasn't the Center of Excellence. And this union said, we can't help you then. He wanted to go to, and it doesn't even matter where he wanted to go either, but it was just a personal choice of his where he wanted to go for help. And the union kind of pulled back and said, that's not union backed. So we really can't, like I said, that's not on the Center of Excellence, not only that, that's on this local that I'm talking about. So I think that one right there really kind of put me over the edge on this. I saw it firsthand for the first time ever. I've always heard stories and all that, but to hear it, like say, and witness it firsthand, I was like, and Doug Monda says it best, man, a first responder's life is not to be compromised, and you may only get one chance. That kid may only reach out one time, and you're going to throw it back in his face and say, either you go here or you're on your own. Because you wait till a guy's struggling, he's at the bottom, finances come in, you know, there's a lot of stuff other involved than just he's struggling. So the finances were a big part for him to get a little help. And in essence, figuratively speaking, they turned their back on him. And that kind of, like I say, that kind of hit home for me actually seeing it the first time.
Doug, you want to jump in on that?
Oh boy, I could go sideways, man. There's this man, I could pounce on some people, but unfortunately, a lot of what Chris has said is very correct. You know, there's two parts of being a first responder. There's the business part of it. We work for a business. A city is run like a business. A municipality is run like a business. But we're human beings, and we include the human element into it. So when Chris used that term that I always say, a first responder, that I'm pretty sure that's our national slogan for Survive First. A first responder's life cannot be compromised. And what that means is, in order to run an effective business, to be a business owner, you have to make compromises. Every year you go through your books, your budgets, and you make compromises. And so do cities. But unfortunately, when it comes to somebody's livelihood, their life, their well-being, their mental well-being, their physical well-being in the first responder world, there is no room to cut corners. There is no room for compromise. And so that's where we're losing the battle, because unions function on money, right? They're all about getting their pay every week, and they're about money, and the same with the departments. And so when it goes between translation from the city and the unions to the police officers, it becomes a business, and the firefighters, police officers, dispatchers, they're getting pushed to the wayside, and they're not getting the quality of care that they could be receiving. And that right there, all the things we've done over the past 10 years, I'm just going to go back 10 years. James, you and I've known each other 10 years, I think now, Chris and Raul. Matter of fact, let me just step back. It's good to see you, man. We've missed you. We know how busy you are. You're still working. We follow you. It's good to see you smiling. But anyway, we tried to make leaps and bounds over the 10 years, but we're still in the same spot. The numbers haven't changed. The suicide rate is still radical. The amount of depression and anxiety and the accumulative trauma and stress that first responders are going through and getting, that hasn't changed any over time. If anything, it's probably gotten worse. And unfortunately, a lot of people went by numbers, data-driven things and numbers. And in the mental health world, when it comes to suicide and things like that, then numbers are grossly projected. They're not working, and we can't base it on that. We basically have to base it on the quality of care within the agencies. The states need to be better involved, and the big organizations, the unions, and the on the law enforcement side, the international chiefs of police, the FBI National Academy, organizations like that in the fire world, the IFF, et cetera, they need to be doing a better job and getting more involved in helping us create a better plan for quality care for first responders. That's kind of where I'm at.
Raul, your perspective.
Yeah. First thing I want to say is that one of the things one of our partners always says is a lot of times it's not the incident, but how we're treated afterwards by the agency. That's what really affects us, right? So this is a huge topic and so important. We still, around the country, find ourselves talking to agency heads, talking to wellness units, peer support people, and finding that the agency just is not, they're not putting their money where their mouth is. They're not following through. They have checked the box. They're happy to have a wellness unit sign on the door, but don't really check to see what's being done. You know, and when these when our people, when our first responders are struggling and needing help, when they need support, true support, the agencies and either they're not equipped to help or just don't care to. And I, that sounds very, very rough and kind of direct and bold, but that's sometimes I think what it is. I agree with what Doug's saying, that these big organizations, maybe they can do more. But as agencies, we've got to take care of ourselves. You know, that, and I can name off organizations, and when we talk on the tactical side, and when we talk with the equipment stuff, and when we talk with the best practices when it comes to officer safety, we don't wait, and I'm saying as a profession, we don't wait for these organizations to say, hey, this is the best thing to do. Or when they do say it's the best thing, we go ahead and do it. Mental health still is lagging behind. I do believe that some of these organizations have said this is what you need to be doing, and we still can't get the needle to move in some agencies in the right direction. You know, we've just talked today to an officer who was involved in a shooting, and after the shooting, when she needed the agency the most, when she just needed support, she just needed presence, no one was there. And that's the type of organizational betrayal we're talking about. And the bad thing is that that's more commonplace than we think.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. Yeah. And just to hit on a couple of things, the box checking, the number of guests I've had on that have done what I call the EAP Russian roulette. So they finally found the courage to ask for help. They've gone to their city or county. They've been given a sheet with a bunch of numbers. They've gone through the list. Some of them are disconnected. Some of them, you know, that they answer and the next scheduling appointment is 6 months from now. Some of them, you know, they finally get someone that ends up being, you know, a child psychologist. Or they finally get someone who declares that they are experts in working with first responders. This person pours their heart out. The counselor starts crying and says, sorry, I can't help you. Can you leave? How many people have we lost? If I've heard those stories, how many people's stories will I never hear? Because that was the last straw. That was the last effort of help. And we betrayed them by putting them in front of the wrong people.
Yeah, that's very true, because that actually happened to me. I had a bad experience with EAP. Back in my day, I had reached out to EAP on my own. My partner at the time, he knew something was bothering me, and I said, yeah, I'm having some issues. And he said, why don't you reach out to EAP? And I did, and they called the EAP program that we had at our agency. You called like a hotline, and then you told them what was going on. I remember telling them, this is what I'm going through. And they said, okay, we'll have somebody contact you. And then I was contacted by a clinician that was local to where I worked at. So it was like right down the street from where I worked at. And as you guys know, where I worked at, there really wasn't any quality of doctors, I would say, in that environment. And so it failed miserably for me by this second visit. And what I've learned, and this is just my observation, and I don't really mean to insult any clinician, because they're all wonderful. They're trying to help people. But what I learned through my journey and the people that I've interviewed and spoke to is that EAP is like the public defender of attorneys. So you can either go out with your money and buy a good attorney, or you can get the free one that hasn't earned their way yet. And so with that notion being spread out there and being observed, first responders just have no trust in EAP. Plus, they understand that EAP bills their city, is in communication with their city. And so there's that trust factor there. So, you know, for an agency just to utilize, and I just went through this, we just helped an officer with alcohol related issues, and he went to his lieutenant and his chief and said, I have a drinking problem and I really need help. And the chief said, well, your drinking problem, are you drinking at work? And he said, no, sir, I only drink when I'm home. And the chief said, well, your problem's at home. That's not our problem. Go get help on your own. Call the AP. And that was really discouraging because there's so many amazing programs out there that are better than just sending them to EAP. And that police officer didn't call EAP. He called me and he said, hey, do you have a better plan for me? And we did. We had a better plan for him. So that's the unfortunate bad side of EAP. It's not all of them. It's some of them. And one thing that I also learned is that everybody always complains about EAP, but your city doesn't have to use that particular EAP program. So if you have union reps in your department, it would behoove them to go out and vet EAP programs. Like our agency, if you called EAP, you got 3 visits. And so I went for 2, and the lady, just like Raul, she looked at me and she was like, oh my God, you're insane and you're crazy. You need to go see somebody else and you need to be on medication. That's just what I got. And so I had to start all over again and tell my story all over again and relive it all over again. And it was just a failed program all the way across the board. But if we took a better, if our union reps and the people in the department that do that stuff, if they took a little bit of better care and a little more time on vetting the appropriate program, it might work better. And what I was going to say was we had 3 visits. But the agency right down the street, they got 36 visits. That's quite a bit of a difference in an EAP program to have 3 visits versus 36 visits. And so, you know, that comes down to, you know, having the proper care in your agency.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's one of those roads, too, they're going to have to. Well, first of all, back up and say again, I want to reiterate. My original story was nothing against the Center of Excellence. I don't want to get hammered by these people because I'm a lover, not a fighter. So I don't like confrontation. But I just had lunch with a guy today who went to Center of Excellence. Great. They do great work. So I want to clear that up if that came out like I was attacking them and I wasn't.
It didn't, Chris.
Okay, good.
But
I was saying that, you know how long it took to build trust between first responders and clinicians, you know, there was always that gap that needed to be bridged, and it's taken a while. I think the same thing with people actually trusting their cities or their peer support or whatever you want to call it. They're going to have to earn that trust because it has, especially as old as we are back in the day, it was always us against them. You know, we were like, especially in the fire department, you know, we had an old city manager one time that said, we don't make him any money. We're a liability, not an asset, you know, because we don't make him any money. But so to earn that trust back, and it's just like, we are so, you know, I'm working now with the First Responder Wellness Division here in Oklahoma State Agency, you know, Danny Long, I think you had him on the show, started. And the amount of calls that we get from people that are going around there, which is fine. I mean, call. Going around their city, going around their peer support because they still just don't have that trust. So I think it's going to be that road of just how we had to build trust with clinicians, which we have now, which is fantastic. I think it's going to be the same kind of road learning to, but they're going to have to lead by example, you know, and do the right thing.
I just wanted to add into that. So, James, if you give me a second here. Chris brought up the one of the magic words is liability. And the agencies still run with that word preceding everything. They worry about liability first and wellness, 15th on the, pecking order. So, because when somebody raises their hand to get help, the first thing that pops in their mind is a liability issue. What's that going to, is this person weak, or is he going to be able to get back to work? And in that mind frame, instead of how can we help this person, get them healthy and see where that goes. I'm dealing with an officer right now in a local agency that is going through some hardships, and they've got a plethora of documentation, things showing that this is a mental health issue, and the agency is reluctant to look at any of it. This is the world according to Raul. This has not been said or anything like that, but because of liability issues. That's what I believe it is. And that word right there, I think, is another reason that you have some of this, what we believe is betrayal, what's perceived to be betrayal, because agency heads are worried about liability.
Yeah, liability is an issue. It was an issue when I had, as I call it, my situation, the liability. I was in charge of a SWAT team, so I had access to automatic weapons, explosives, you name it. And there was just people in the agency that were concerned that a guy that, tried to shoot himself was coming back to work and carrying a gun around the building. And there were employees that worked in the agency I worked at that were concerned about that. And liability was a thing that was talked about me for quite a while. But by the grace of God, I had a police chief who believed in me. And he said, he's not a liability. He's okay. We went and we got him help. And the doctor said he's good to go. He's got a fit for duty letter. And he trusted me. And not only did I do a good job when I came back, I always tell everybody the year after I tried to kill myself, I was officer of the year. And I don't know what it's like in the fire department, but in a police department, to be officer of the year is a really hard task, because we had 70 police officers in our agency. And I, at no time ever in my career would I say I was the best one. Like, I had 70 incredible police officers that I worked with, dispatchers that were amazing, detectives, supervisors, but it's a pretty hard task. And I owe that all to that chief who stuck behind me and got me help. And when I came back to work, I was healthy and happy. What he did was he did what most chiefs don't do. He didn't look at the liability. He didn't look at the cost factor. He looked at the human factor. And I know this because he said it out loud. They even wrote an article about him. He said, not only was this guy one of my employees, he was also my friend over these years. And there's a time where you have to put your work role to the side and bring your humanity out and look at somebody and go, hey, how much is this person's life worth? That was one of the very first lessons I learned as a police officer was I had a knife in my pocket, and it was just a cheap Ace Hardware knife. And before I was a cop, I was an ocean lifeguard. And so I used to carry this cheap knife in my shorts when I, a couple times I had to go out and cut people from fishing nets off the piers and things like that. So it became like a lucky knife. And it was an $8 knife. And I brought it into work when I first became a cop. And my supervisor, who ultimately became my SWAT commander, he pulled the knife out of my pocket and he looked at it and he threw it in a garbage can. And I go, what'd you do that for? And he looked at me and he goes, how much did that knife cost? And I said, $8. And he looked at me and he said, so you're going to tell me your life is worth $8? And I said, no, my life's worth way more than that. And he said, the next time you buy a piece of equipment that's going to help you or save you, don't spare any money. Buy the absolute best piece of equipment you can afford to buy. And that's what your life is worth. Your life isn't worth $8. So I say all that to say this. How do you put a price tag on somebody's head? Not even an employee, just somebody. I mean, you think about as firefighters and as police officers, when somebody calls 911 and they're laying in the middle of the street begging for help, whether it's an injury or an assault or just a bad day for them, our agencies spare no expense on going and helping those people. I mean, we got two firefighters and two cops right here. Have you ever in your career seen us go, oh, we're not going to do this because it costs a lot of money? No, we spare no expense. But when it comes time to ourselves and our own agencies, we compromise. And so there's a lot to be said behind that. There's a lot of work to be done to ratify, or is that the right word I'm looking for, to rectify or ratify, to fix this situation. I'm still learning how to talk again, James. So, you know, to get this fixed, like I said, it goes all the way to a state level. You know, over the past 10 years, James, like I've really transitioned in my role in this industry. I have my hands at the state level now. You know, I work with the state of Florida on their wellness unit. I just like Chris, I do a lot of stuff and Raul around the state of Florida. And so I see it from the governmental level at the Capitol all the way down to the police officer. And I'm going to give you an example of one of the things that is happening that we have to look at. In the state of Florida, we do a thing called a post-critical incident seminar. Most people know it as a PCIS. The three of us, I don't know if you've been to one, James, but I know me, Chris, and Raul have been to one. And it's a free program that is put on by the state. And it's a three-day intensive workshop. It's probably the most healing, the most incredible mental health thing that I have observed yet. I've been involved in maybe 8 or 10 of them now since we started doing them. And we allow 35 couples into the seminar. And I literally get to watch 35 couples heal and smile again and go from the first day of crying, telling their story, to the second day laughing with their mates and healing. And it's a great thing to be part of. But here's the bad side of it. The state of Florida, which is governed by an organization called FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, they put these post-critical incident seminars out for anybody who wants to come in the first responder world, corrections, dispatch, cops, fire. It's pretty amazing. And they put that out there. They send it to every agency in the state of Florida. Every police chief gets, and every agency gets this invitation for them to send their employees. Well, one of the things we discovered is the chief, hypothetically, and you know, I don't know how it works in everybody's agency, but the chief gets the email and the invitation and the flyer. Then it goes from him or the training department to the command level. Hey, disseminate this to your employees. Well, one of the things that's happening is when it gets to that level, it's not getting to the employees because the command level is going, well, if I give this to this shift, what do they call it for the fireside? Is it a shift or is it a battalion?
Shift. Or battalion. Shift. Battalion would be, you know, the shift is which of the days that we work, and the battalion would be, you know, seven stations of that particular area.
Yeah.
Okay. So that particular shift, just like us in law enforcement. And so if I give this to this shift, I know that three officers on this shift or three firefighters were traumatically damaged at an incident, whether it be in the Pulse nightclub, Oklahoma bombing, whatever it is that we've all been involved in, or just a shooting. These three officers were involved in a shooting. They really need this seminar. But if I send them to the seminar, I'm going to be three bodies down on the shift. And that's going to cost overtime. And we don't have the staffing to fill overtime. So all that takes place, that command level person doesn't put that information out because he don't even want to tease the employees with it because they're knowing that they're not going to go. And so that right there, just that one incident that's taken place, and that's just here in the state of Florida. And I'm not bashing anybody. That's just the price of doing business and the nature of the beast that we're in. But that's kind of what's taking place. And the way to fix that is at a state level, a funding level, and which you could track that all the way down to people that go out and vote for their elected officials. That's why it's so important that we vet, that we do the right thing, and we take the time to vote the proper people in the seat, and also make sure that when you're going to work for an agency, make sure they're a great agency. Make sure they have a track record and they have all these things. There's a million different ways you can look at it, but these are some of the things that are happening here in what we're involved in.
Doug, you talked about us being seen as a business, and I've made this comment a few times. I think this is where in the fireside I see the greatest organizational betrayal. If you actually look at the business world, they, I don't know if you've seen these news articles, it happens here in America, but also Iceland, the UK have done, you know, a trial of this. The progressive business world has actually shifted to a 4-day work week, 4 9-hour days with a 1-hour lunch. So they're realizing the Googles, the Amazons, et cetera, if you invest in your people, Richard Branson from Virgin is a perfect example. He's like, if my people are happy, the customer will be happy, not the other way around. And so then you look at the fire, and a perfect example, in my opinion, at the moment of organizational betrayal is you have management administrators who work 40 hours a week, who are also responsible for our recruitment crisis because they were the leadership, who are telling 56-hour a week firefighters, you don't deserve to work less than 56. And, you know, these people go to their families every night at 5. The firefighters work 56. And then as we get through a deeper recruitment crisis, now you're talking about mandatory overtime, 80-hour weeks, etc. Now let's take our union, the IAFF. I'm not worried about offending anyone, Chris, so I'll carry this one. They work in a city that works a 42-hour work week, 24/72. There's no conversation about them advocating for the rest of the country working the work week that they are. So this is where I see a huge organizational betrayal. You're wearing the gold badge, or you're getting all the union dues, and you're supposed to be fighting for your people, and you're like, well, I'm all right. That's it. If you were a Google, a Virgin, a progressive business leader, you would say the most important asset I have is not the Ariel, it's not the Bearcat, it's the men and women in the uniform. And I think this is where that shift has to change. If you're in any of these positions and other people aren't the most important thing to you, then you should not be in that position, whether we're talking in politics or we're talking about administrator or unions. Your number one job is to make sure that your membership, your, you know, men and women serve beneath you, are physically prepared, mentally prepared, and go home when they're supposed to go home. And I think this is a big part of the conversation when it comes to organizational betrayal, is just the mistakes of our management, our, you know, the people that collected the big checks that had the stripes all down their arm are being paid for by the men and women who are actually on the streets. And that is so unfair.
I'll
tell you, I was just out in LA a couple of weeks ago, out there for a week, and we all have a friend that's an LA County firefighter. Y'all know who I'm talking about. The amount of mandatory overtime these guys are working is absolutely insane. Now they're racking up the bank account, and they get paid well for it. But I was shocked at the amount of mandatory. How many? There's some guy that when I was out there, they were working their sixth or seventh shift in a row. And they did mention though, even in, I think it was LA, they even did mention that it's been proposed talking about doing a, whatever that's called, looking into it, a study about changing their shift and everything, their hours and their going to, cause they work the LA works the exact same as Oklahoma City, the Kelly day, 24 on, 24 off three times and all 4 days in a row. And, it's 56 hours. And, but I was shocked. I'm like you. I never looked at it like that as being organizational, but that's who's, it's mandatory. I mean, so it is, it's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, this is what we got to do. I mean, this is what you have to do, or we'll find somebody else to do it. You know, basically, amount of overtime they're working is not sustainable. There's no way.
I think we get caught. Well, I think leadership gets caught into the, we're doing it that way because that's the way we've always done it. You know, and we've been doing it that way for the last 30 years. I survived. I mean, isn't that what we hear a lot, James? I mean, that's, you know, I survived, so you ought to be able to survive too. And I keep saying, but guys, like in every career, in every generation before us, there were things that happened that helped evolve the profession to where we are now, whether it be technology, studies, whatever the case, whatever it is. So I always like, what are we talking about? Why are we not always looking to make it better? I don't understand the mentality of, well, that's the way we've always done it. It's always worked, so it can't be fixed. Like, what are you talking about?
Can you imagine, right, Raul, if you had to make entry to the Pulse nightclub with a, you know, musket, and you had to reload it every time? Well, that's the way we always did it.
right, exactly. It's exactly my point. I mean, it just makes no sense because in every, and correct me if I'm wrong, in every generation, every administration, leadership, there's always something new. There's always a change. It should always be something. You know, because every time I go to conferences around the country, when I went to the firefighter conference, the big one up in Indianapolis, I think, Indianapolis, they man, that thing was huge. And they had truly, you were out there looking for the better mousetrap. I mean, there was everything out there. You know, so we should always be looking to make it better. Why are we fighting that? I don't get it.
Well, and firefighters are, and I guess we're like cops. I don't know if cops are the same. Firefighters hate two things: the way things are and change. So, you know, they're beating themselves up. But like you said, they always want the newest, best, and brightest toy, you know, or tool to play with. So they're ready for that to change. You know, if we had this, we could do better. We had that. Well, but there is so much tradition in, I can't speak for the cops, but there is so much tradition in the fire service that if they feel like if they change something, like you say, the work hours that, you know, like Oklahoma City, they've had that same, they went to a third platoon in 1965. That's when they started that that cycle. So they've been doing it since 1965. And that's just, I don't think they think there's another way to do it. Those guys out in LA I was talking to, because I was saying, I don't know how the Oklahoma City guys and girls would go for that if they jump on board, because they only know what we do now. And those guys and girls out there were like, oh, we would love it. We would love to go 24/72 or whatever it is. So, but like you say, it's, I'm like you, Raul. I don't know why we, now, when I was on the job and young and stupid, I was the same way. Don't mess with my job. Don't mess with my tradition. This is how we do it, you know. And, but as I've gotten older and mellowed, and yeah, I don't know why we fight things that are going to only make us better as firefighters and as people and as husbands, as fathers, as wives. It's going to make us better in every aspect, and we want to fight it to the core.
And we got to make it clear, we're not talking about half-cocked ideas, right? We're not talking about, well, you know, yeah, I heard this guy, Chris, said if we do 27 hours and 79 off, that's the way to go. He woke up one night and said that, and that's the way we – no, this is backed by – and James, I don't mean to – you know, tell me. This is backed. This isn't just a fad. There's evidence – based stuff. I mean, so I don't, yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. I can get on the soapbox there.
No, you're absolutely right. It is evidence based. It has been for years. James, we actually, our agency, we were on 410s. We had gone through all the shifts, and we spent most of my career on the 410s. And I'll tell you, one thing my agency did right is they got the shift down so that everybody in the agency had 3 days off, which at 410s isn't a backbreaker, because if you work eights, you generally work 10s anyway, the time you get settled in and settled out. And everybody had a weekend day off. You either had a Saturday off, you either had Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, or you had Saturday, Sunday, and Monday off. And so, you know, the young guy got just as much quality time as the old guy did, and it worked well for us. But the guys who, the old timers, and I've had this conversation with several, I'll use her old timer, I'm an old timer, but guys that have been around longer than me. When I first came back to work after my suicide attempt, I had older guys ask me questions. And I'll never forget this one guy, and I love him to this day, but he looked at me and he was kind of mad at me. And he said he didn't understand me because I've looked at you all these years and all you do is train and exercise, right, in my athletic world. And he said, you take such good care of yourself, and I don't see how you could have a problem. And what, you know, it just looks to me that you're looking for the easy way out type conversation. And he said, I've been doing this job longer than you, and I've done all the things you've done, and I've been through all the things you've been, and I'm fine. And I looked over at him and I said, you're fine. I said, your cheeks are as red as a brake light. You've taken 10 deep breaths in one sentence. Your belly sticks so far past your belt buckle, you haven't seen your boy part in 20 years. You don't even know what it looks like. Your high blood pressure is through the roofs. I tore this dude a new ass, is what I did. And I said, so you're not okay. You just chose a different route. You choose your mental breakdown can look like overeating, diabetes, overdrinking, not sleeping, things of that nature. Everybody has a different path of it. So a lot of these old timers that think they're okay, they're really not okay. They just think they are. And they're just as scared of the change as the new guys. And you're right, Chris. Cops don't like change either. The only thing that is different between cops and firefighters is we don't like fire. So fuck that. We decided to go pick up guns. That's the only difference. Y'all like fire. We don't like fire. But other than that, we're just alike.
I'm not a fan of lead poisoning, so you can keep your job too.
Thank you.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
It's funny though with the way we've always done it. I've done a presentation a couple of times on the 2472 only when people have asked me, and I know it's a kind of force multiplier audience because I don't talk normally. It's why it's called Behind the Shield. But there's a couple of slides. One of them are children in the Victorian ages when we had them working in factories and cleaning chimneys as young as 8 years old. That's the way we used to do it till someone went, that looks awful. We should probably not send our children because they keep dying from all these cancers. Another one is a surgical residency. You know, when they were doing, you know, crazy hours in the medical school track, there was a physician, I think it was Dr. Edward Halsett, if I've got that right. And he was kind of one of the people that really created this residency where he would be up for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, as anyone listening, if that's what your professor's doing, your teacher, your coach, your lieutenant, that's what you're going to do. So that stayed. And then years and years later, they kind of looked back and went, oh, this guy was addicted to cocaine and heroin. Now, I'm pretty sure I could do a 2-day bender on those. So just because that was the way it was done doesn't mean it's the right way, whether it's, you know, children in a Victorian factory, whether it's a coked up surgeon, just because that's how you did it in the past. And I tell my people, you know, Chris has got the helmets behind him. People will call that tradition. No, that's a hat. Tradition is camaraderie. It's courage. It's, you know, it's teamwork. It's selfless service. That's tradition. And so the innovation in what we're wearing, innovation in the tools, and the innovation in the human performance, that's not tradition. Tradition is forging the best police officer or firefighter, and that involves innovation. You do not let go of tradition by forging a path to be a better first responder.
That's right.
That's very well said.
Yeah, like you said, James, especially in the fire world, remember everybody wanted to have the melted shield or your gear so black and dirty that you couldn't tell what city you worked for. But what do we do now? Right. Now you have two or three sets of gear. You immediately get deconned after every, you know, fire alarm. We leave our self-contains on through salvage and overhaul now, which is, it didn't change anybody's bravery, didn't change anybody what they're willing to do. It's just a safer, better way to do the job. And like you said, that's why we all do what we do. I want every first responder, cop, firefighter, dispatcher, man, I want them to do their 25, their 30, whatever they want to do, and get to retirement. I've got too many, we all know too many that didn't get to retirement or didn't get many years of it. The one is always on me. I made a guy I used to work with actually made his suicide after he retired on a call. And that has always stuck with me. And I thought, I don't want anybody else to have to experience, you know, that to see a brother that didn't get to get, you know, like I said, I enjoy sticking to the every month they have to cut me that pension check. They're like, damn, he made another one. So that's what I want everybody to do. Keep drawing them checks as long as they can.
Well, just to jump in again, Doug made the comment about, you know, the figures not really showing the whole picture. And this is something that I've talked about. And again, in this presentation, one of the slides was supposedly, I think it was suicides. The American Fire Service in 2024 had, it was like 73, 77, something like that. Now, I can tell you in the state of Florida alone that we've had close to that. You know, I mean, locally, we've had, you know, I can count several on one hand. That's just in this county and the surrounding area. So, but I asked the audience, I'm like, yeah, but so that's obviously underrepresented as far as, you know, them not being reported. Let's, you know, not forget about the alcohol and drug related deaths. That's the same exact issue, the mental health crisis. I said, but what's the largest part of this puzzle that we're missing? Our retirees. The military doesn't discount any death after you stop wearing the uniform. They have a thing called the VA that keeps counting as these veterans progress through the years. And most of these diseases and mental health crises are going to really manifest in your 50s, 60s. That's when we see most of them. So, for example, if I did anything, I took my own life, I dropped dead of an aneurysm, I got cancer, I ceased to be a statistic in any fire, anything. So this is the other thing, is that we're acting like we only have a small amount in police and fire. But actually, if you look at the retirees, I would argue genuinely that the statistics that were given are, 10%, if even that, of all the retirees that we lose so many years prematurely. And that's not being factored into the magnitude of this crisis.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, we were talking about some of that today, Doug, when you were at the class today. FDLE is trying to what's the word I'm looking for? They're trying to correct some of that reporting in reference to, you know, police suicide around the state. Because I think in the last few years, it's been, you know, single digits is what's been reported. Well, they went back and started looking and come to find out that it's more like in the 40s every year. And that's not counting retirees, and then that's not counting the suspicious accidents, right? So, and still, there's still under, there's still agencies that haven't reported anything, you know, so they're just not reporting those incidents. So, yeah, I think the number is grossly underreported when you start adding in the retirees and I don't. I still don't know if there's a mechanism to do that yet. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And you know, I know the numbers are important to people. And you're right about the numbers. I want to say it was 4 were reported for the state of Florida last year. And Florida is a big ass state, as we all know, really big state. And, you know, for years there was organizations, maybe 1 or 2 of them that provided all the data nationally to the organizations. And they were only reporting the data that was reported to them. And so they came and they did their announcement, excuse me, and they said Florida had 4 suicides. Well, the deputy commissioner of Florida heard that. And he's like, that's not true, because I know of more than 4. That we've had this year. So he went and did this in-depth study and found out that it was 44. And he went to the state and said, this is unacceptable. But him and I had this conversation. I was part of that conversation up at the Capitol. And one of the things that I told him was, how about just one suicide, whether it's a firefighter, cop, dispatcher, corrections officer, whatever it might be in the first responder world, to even include, you know, a lot of the flight medics and the nurses that fly out the scene, right? Any one of those people, one of them is enough. One should be enough. We should not be losing. You know, everybody goes, oh, well, you know, they emphasize a lot on police officers who lost their lives and firefighters who've lost their lives in the line of duty. God bless them. I agree with it. But what are we doing about the officer or firefighter that's taking, as radical as it is, taking their own life due to a traumatic event that's happened in the course of their career? You know, why do we not look at that the same, you know, and why do we not put as much care, as much funding, as much effort into that as we do the officers? That, I mean, where I live at, they just had a burial. They had a parade, a burial of a police dog, a police dog. Now, I love police dogs. I've had them my whole career. But they also had an officer that killed himself. And nobody from that department did anything for that officer who killed himself. But they had a parade and a funeral for a dog that just died of natural causes, not being shot in the line of duty. And so what do you think that agency looks at? Oh, I am no better than a dog in the street. I'm not even worth that. And that's a problem that we have in its own, is the way we look at it. And maybe you would call that the stigma. I don't really like that word. I just think of it as, that's just poor taste in leadership and poor taste in the way we look at the things we do. And we just have to do a better job of, you know, brings me back to, we put our lives on the line every day for people we don't know. We don't even know. They don't even like us. especially as cops. Shit, everybody loves a firefighter, but everybody hates the police. And we put our lives on the line for those people, but for the people that we love and we work with, we're not giving them the same amount of care. And that narrative has to change.
Well, with that, I want to throw something at you before we go to what you refer to as the mental health boom. So I think that's fascinating. That's something we need to unpack as well. I talk a lot about the issues with with firefighter recruitment. And obviously, one of the biggest fixes, and we're seeing this, the proof is in the pudding in Florida now. You change the work week, you show these people that you care. All of a sudden, people are lining up around the building to work for you. And it's not the only thing. Then you put in fitness standards and, you know, zero, cost to access mental health. And, you know, now all of a sudden you're building this positive culture. You're choosing the top 10% of a list. You know, it's a self-licking ice cream by that point. Law enforcement, though, you know, there isn't, I mean, with the recruitment crisis and the overtime, absolutely. But with the work week, you know, it's not that same obvious, biggest glaring issue that we need to fix first. But it's obviously more organizational betrayal. And that could even be organizationally, nationally, through the media and the way that, you know, the men and women in blue are portrayed. So I'm much more naive to this, especially Raoul and Doug. Talk to me about law enforcement. What have we got to do to turn things around so young men and women line up excited to put on the uniform like they did when you guys entered the profession?
Whew. Man, loaded question.
I've got one answer right away, Raoul, while you figure yours out. One of them is we have to get rid of that anti-cop rhetoric. We cannot allow that in our country anymore. And unfortunately, that era that we went through, the George Floyd era and a few other eras, it painted this horrible picture of a cop. And one of the examples I like to use, Chris, who's not on the show, Chris tells people, he says, listen, if you hire a plumber and he comes to your house and he does a crappy job, does that mean all the other plumbers in the world suck and you're never going to hire another one? It's no different as being a police officer. Just because one police officer makes a mistake doesn't mean the whole world has to turn on every one of them. And when we saw that take place, why would you want to take a job where you're going to go do your job and be spit on and it potentially hurt and damaged and shot at and not be trusted and all these things? If we don't fix that, we're not going to have police. We are so nationally short in police officers. I was just in Hawaii a couple weeks ago, speaking in Maui to the firefighters and cops that were involved in the Maui fires. And there are 480 police officers down and three police chiefs. And it just blows my mind away. Like, what you would think that everybody be lining up to be a cop in the great state of Hawaii. But, you know, obviously there's cause factors, but not. That's the same thing that we have across the nation. Just nobody wants to be a cop anymore. And we're putting ourselves in a very dangerous position where crime will go rampant and things of that nature. So we have to obviously get backing from the top and end this type of, I use the word anti-cop rhetoric, and I'm stealing that from a famous sheriff I saw on TV. He said that. I don't even really know what that means, but it sounded good. But we do have to get rid of that. I'm just joking. But we do have to get rid of that. And we have to paint a better picture. And we have to fund. We have to fund these agencies. It baffles me. This country will send billions of dollars to other countries that we've never even been to or we don't even know. But we don't take care of our own the way we should. And that's just my take on it. We just have to do a better job of taking care of the people who take care of us.
Yeah, I think one of the answers is going to, of course, people are looking for jobs, and police are, you know, you make an okay living, you know, depending on where you're going. So you're going to have people coming up. But in reference to shortages, that's across the board. I mean, and we just also, he forgot, I remind him, but we just came back from Los Angeles probably like a month and a half ago or so. And they're like 3,000 short.
It's insane.
They're supposed to be there for like 13,000 and they're like at 9. So, you know, and that's the same for Chicago and for LAPD. And so that's around the country for the most part. I think funding is a big deal. You know, pay the cops better. You'll probably have more people coming. That's just, that's an easy one, low hanging fruit right there. You know, back when we joined as police officers, if you made a mistake, it was handled internally. I'm not talking about criminal stuff and you know, you need to go to jail. I got no problem with that. If you're police and you do a crime, then you go to jail like anybody else. But if you're doing the job, and a mistake is made, you're doing it right, you know, you get the right intent, but a mistake is made, it used to be handled internally. You'd written up, you have a policy violation and so forth and so on. Now, any mistake is looked at, if it's criminal first, then they look to see if you had a policy violation. And you know, there's a bunch of examples I can give you. I'm not going to get into that. That's a huge debate. But we have to get back to agencies backing the people for doing the right thing for the right reasons. Sometimes the outcome is not going to be, you know, cookie cutter. I'll give you a quick example of this. I just thought of one popped in my head. We had an officer that took down a woman that went across a courtyard threatening another woman. She walked across the courtyard yelling and threatening another woman about how she's going to beat her ass. She gets within feet of the other woman, about to put hands on her. Officer intercepts her and takes her down to the ground. Handcuffs her. Now, when he took her down, she hit her head. It was an accident. First thing that was done was they wanted the officer charged with a crime. That's the days we live in right now. And We're held. I've got no problem with us being held to a higher standard. We should be. We should be held to a higher standard. We're the first responders. I've got no problem with that. But we're being held to a perfect standard now. And I don't know if that's attainable, you know. And California, they just had a case. Not just, but a year and a half ago or so, that's one of the things the jury said. If it's not perfect, then it's a violation of the law. If that continues, I don't know the answer to your question.
Well, just to dovetail on that, and I'll throw it to Chris from an outside perspective too. You mentioned California. I saw a news article a few weeks ago. Someone sent it to me. LAFD, the fire department of LA, their overtime budget for over a 3-year period was $1 billion with a B. So firstly, the money is there. As Chris said, I've used this term all the time. It's a Desmond Tutu quote. We spend so much time pulling people out of the river, we forget to go upstream and find out why they're falling in the first place. The money is there, but it's wasted on all the time and a half you're paying, forcing these people to work these spots. Again, let's be completely honest, because you fucked it up from a management point of view for years and years and years. There's no point using, you know, kindergarten terms for that. You've got the lack of retention. So you pay police officers, firefighters, you know, to go through training, and then they up sticks and they go somewhere else with all your certifications that you paid for. You've got the workman's comp claims that are through the roof. You got the medical, you know, retirements. You got the, God forbid, line of duty death payments. And then you've got the millions of dollars in the lawsuits when we do make the mistakes. Now you've created a recruitment crisis, lowered the bar. Now I've seen, you know, law enforcement agencies offer tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars of signing bonuses. What is the quality of the candidate going to be like now? I had a retired police officer on the show a while ago who said that for every bad employee that you hire, it takes $500,000 to get rid of them. So imagine, we'd use the word liability. What is the liability of allowing your department to be in such crisis that now you're lowering the bar, thinking that's going to fix it, getting the wrong kind of people in uniform? And we've all seen those videos. And now you've just made everything worse. Rather than going downstream saying, holy shit, we've wasted all this money, let's invest in our police department. Let's fix the things that are broken. Let's put the salary where it needs to be. Let's give them tax breaks or whatever so they can afford to live in this overly priced affluent city. And then let's, you know, get them back. Because the Wall Street Journal had an article a few months ago showing that Gen Z actually was going into the trades. But they look at our professions and they're like, hell no. Law enforcement, right, their legs get cut from under them. Fire is so overworked that they never see their family. And if you Google health issues with the fire service, it's a Wikipedia that's 10 pages long, you know? So fix the things that are broken, you will bring the people back. But I think that the nation has got to understand that this isn't like the line hasn't tapered off. It's still descending, and there is going to be a point of critical mass. And if we do not fix it, you will call 911 and no one's going to come. That's not scaremongering. It's the truth.
Yeah, you'll be put on hold. We're heading that, James, you hit it on the head. We're heading that way. It's scary to think about it, but when you start hearing, when you start going to these bigger agencies and you hear that the 3,000 understaffed, the, you know, Chicago, I forget, some crazy like that as well. But it's relative around the country. When you go to PDs that are 1,000, they're 100 or 200 down, which is a big number for them. If you only got 1,000, you know, officers, you know. So, we're unfortunately that there's going to be a day you're going to be put on hold.
Chris,
I kind of what Doug hit on was like the anti-cop kind of rhetoric. You know, it's just like I don't. And like he said, in most cases, everybody loves firefighter, except management. But
I was thinking the same thing. But administrator.
Yeah, but I was thinking like what Doug said, about the plumber kind of, you know, just you would never not call a plumber anymore because you had one bad one. Anytime I notice there's a story about, you know, looking on Reels or Instagram, just following stuff and. There's a story about a cop that did something, you know, great or did this for this elderly person. You'll see somebody comment and say, you know, wish there was more like this. I wish there's, but when you see a cop that does something like Raul said, that needs some discipline, needs whatever, and they do something wrong, the immediate remark is just like all the rest of them, you know. So like when they do something good every night, you'll say, well, there's a few good, but then when they do something bad, it's like all the rest of them, they all get put in this one category. Because they're under such public scrutiny, it is crazy. If they would go behind the scenes of a fire department and what a fire chief deals with every day of this employee getting a DUI or this employee involved in domestic violence, or this employee involved in this or involved. I mean, we're just, the fire world doesn't get the public scrutiny that the officers do. And I've got several buddies here who retired cops, and they've discouraged their sons. Two of them are actually in the fire service now. And that's a sad statement that you would actually discourage somebody from being a police officer. I mean, it's just insane. And that's another thing. I think, it's one of the things we want a quick fix, and it's not going to be quick.
Yeah. It took 20, 30 years to destroy it. It's going to take more than one, fiscal year to fix it.
Yeah.
You got that right, James.
That's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Police officers are definitely guilty until proven innocent. I mean,
yeah.
Without a doubt, it's sad.
And it's just going to get worse because, like I said, not just the bar, but for every police and fire, for every person who's forced to work extra shifts, it's, again, going back to science, neuroscience, sleep medicine science, we are more likely to make mistakes. So I always said, when do you ever hear when there's that gray area, shooting or whatever it is in law enforcement? You've got the good shoot, and then you've got the clearly the police completely screwed up. We know of the both of those.
Right.
But the one in the middle, the teenager's, nervous. He's 17. He just started. He reaches for his license or his insurance papers that are in the glove box. And there's this confusion. It's tinted. And all of a sudden, shots are fired. When is anyone ever talking about how many shifts has that officer worked? When was the last time they slept? What was their training level? It's always on the officer they made a mistake. And the thing is, the more understaffed a department gets, the more underslept, overstressed these men and women are, and the lower the bar is created, you're just increasing the chance. So this defund thing and everything else is like, oh, let's make it worse. The same way as when COVID swept through, you couldn't have made it worse if you tried than saying, stay at home, don't see anyone you love, order fast food and alcohol, and binge watch Tiger King. That'll do it. You know what I mean? So everything that we were told was completely the opposite. And it's the same with law enforcement. If you look at Finland, in their education system, when there's a school in an area that's struggling, maybe socioeconomically is not as fortunate as other areas, they pour more money into it and they bring it up with everyone else. What do we do in America? We penalize those schools in the poor areas and we take funding away from them. It's the same with, the first responder professions, and we need to switch that around.
Yeah. Dang, James Gearing for president.
I wouldn't want to do that.
Bro, you got my vote. That sounded better than I've heard in the past three or four presidents right there. So,
I'm blessed. On the head, shit.
Great conversation. This conversation opens the doors to many different pathways in our profession that could be worked on. I hope a lot of people get to see this and take this narrative back to work with them and try to improve it and work on it. Because if we don't, it's not going to get better. It's not going to fix itself. We've got to put more effort into it. And I'm all for it. I know on my end, I just said this the other day to a buddy of mine. He was like, man, I never see you anymore. And I said, man, I wish I was still a cop. It was easier. I work harder now than I ever have in my, I was a drug agent, man. How hard is it to buy and sell drugs and go out and drink and go to bars and do that stuff? But this journey here it's difficult. And what people don't realize too, the bottom end of this conversation, the very bottom end when it comes to mental health, is when you got to pick up that phone and you have a first responder on the other end of that phone who's got a gun in their mouth and their wife screaming in the background, help me, help me, help my husband. And you're on the other line trying everything you can to talk that person out of taking their own life. And the problem that this person is having is due to signing up to be a hero. Every police officer and firefighter, the minute you sign that line, you become an instant hero. Same with the military, the day you acknowledge that you are going to sacrifice your life for the better better, you know, livelihood of human beings, that puts you in a hero category. And we need to treat those people like such. And I just hope that somewhere along the line, we just start doing a better job. You could always do better. I believe in that. We could be, we could do better, and we need to do a better job of taking care of each other.
Absolutely.
Agreed. When I get to speak, Mal, I always, always end it with this real quick. You know, we're talking about taking care of each other. When I retired March 1st, 2017, after 32 years of service, you know what happened on March 2nd? They promoted somebody and put them in my seat. And the Oklahoma City Fire Department hasn't missed a beat. Orlando, Coco, I can't remember the last one you worked at.
There. America I work for, so pick one.
Oh, there you go. None of them have called us to ask us to come back to work, except maybe for Doug, or ask our opinion about anything. So, man, we do. We got to take care of each other at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Well, do you guys have time to just look at talk about the mental health boom and you know different organizations that you run and that you trust for people that are listening before I let you go?
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So let's talk about that. I've, again, 9 years, still kind of a baby compared to, you know, the real kind of long toothed individuals in the mental health space and first responders. But in that short time, I've seen the initial, you know, we need to smash the stigma to the evolution of the conversation. But sadly, I've seen some fantastic organizations that have been there for the right reason. And I've seen even how people approach me to want to sponsor the show. Organizations that even in the rhetoric, they haven't disguised the fact that there's a lot of money to be made in first responder mental health. So talk to me about the, you know, what you term the mental health boom. And let's talk about that. You know, what have been some of the low points when it comes to what it was supposed to be trusted organizations in this? And then what are you seeing today so that there's some, you know, some optimism for people looking for organizations that won't let them down?
I don't know. Doug is probably more well-spoken on some of the organizations that he's seen come and go because of his work with Survive First and all that. As far as the optimism, I do see, like I say, it's going to be slow, you know, and like we always say, if we just reach that, you know, that one person, and you really have to believe that because it gets frustrating at times. I've thought several times about just going, you know what, I'm tired of just like I'm talking to the wall or, you know, whatever. But being optimistic, I do see a shift. It's a slow one, but I do see a shift. I spoke at a little town here in Oklahoma just the other day. They have a little recruit academy going on at like a Votech technology school. And the one of the towns that's around there came. And I was really encouraged for the fact that the fire chief was sitting in there, the assistant fire chief was sitting in there, one of the people from the city council was sitting in there, you know? So the fact that the mental health stuff is being talked about earlier in careers now, instead of, you know, waiting until, like say, they're in the river and drowning. But to see that fire chief, real quick, I was in Sacramento for a week. And I did like my presentation like two times a day to get all the four platoons that they have and all that. At the very end, the fire chief had kind of stuck his head in and out when he could, you know. Well, the last day he came in, he was in there about the last 20 or 30 minutes. And when I got done, he said, "Hey, I want to come up there." And he started thanking me and thanking the peer support team. I don't know what conviction came over him. Dude, he spoke for an hour, told his story, and when I got done, I told their peer support, I said, "Let me tell you something. I appreciate you having me out for a week." And all I said, but this group got more from that 45 minutes from that fire chief than they did from anything I said, because that's their fire chief. Yes. He just got up there in front of everybody and was vulnerable. And, you know, so that's the optimism I see. I see a shift towards that, and that's encouraging.
Yeah, there's a lot of good chiefs out there, and there's a lot of good people out there still doing a good job. You know, it's just in this day and age, everybody gets all their information from social media. And unfortunately, social media only wants to show horrible stuff, combat, fights, lies, deception, because that's what sells. And unfortunately, there's a lot of good people out there doing a lot of good work. And there's a lot of good organizations in the mental health field doing a great job. Our organization has been, I'll say, I'm not going to say we're the best, even though I think we do a great job. But I will say this, one thing that this organization has done, and which I preach to a lot of people, is we've stayed in our lane the entire time. When we came to this platform, we made an agreement of what we were going to provide, the service we were going to provide for first responders, and that's all we've ever done. And with in the boom, as you asked, James, when the boom kicked off, everybody and their brother, and that's just unfortunate of humankind, were greedy and were money driven. And everybody saw all these opportunities to make money in the first responder industry, because they just think first responders, their business, their cities, their governments, they have money, to spend. And companies came out of the woodworks. Phone companies came and dumped money, car companies, you name it, big corporations came in, dumped tons of money into the mental health industry only to boost their company. And then they took their money and they left and they're all gone. And all the fly-by-night companies that came in and tried to make a quick dollar, they're all gone. The people that are still around. And the second part of your question, what organizations would we vouch for? I mean, there's tons, depending what department or what arena you look in. But what I would say to anybody is do your research. You always want to look for the organization or the treatment center or the provider or the therapeutic group or whatever it is. Look for lineage. I think, James, you and I had this conversation a long time ago about martial arts. You and I are both former martial artists. And I went to the Gracies for jiu-jitsu because I looked at their lineage. They had been around for so long, and they have proven over decades their quality of work that they've done. You have to do the same thing in this industry. You have to look for lineage, look for quality control, look how long they've been around, look at their you know, look into their company, look at the good things they've done, look at their ratings, because you're dealing with somebody's life and you don't want to compromise them and just hire some kook who just showed up yesterday and decided, I'm going to start a business and I'm going to make a bunch of money. And so I go to this police department and I tell them, hey, I can do this for you. Never done it before in their life, but that chief or that agency sees an opportunity to check a box. And they can check the box because this dude's going to sell you his class for $500. But this dude over here who's been around for 5, 10, 12, 15 years, he's going to charge $800, but we're not going to go with him because this guy's $300 more cheaper. That's what we have to do, is we have to focus in order to fix that problem, is really take our time and research who it is we're looking for and what it is we're looking for and the lineage and of that company, and also their rating. And are they doing the right thing? Are they ethically doing the right thing? Are they honorably doing the right thing? One thing that I've always said with my organization, and the guys will tell you this, I have never let anybody come near this organization that has a red flag on them. If your organization has a red flag or multiple red flags, you can't come play in our game. You can't come play in our arena because there's no room for error in this industry. Because if there is error in this industry, it could cause somebody's life. And that's unacceptable to me. So I say it again, really take your time and look into the organizations, the programs, the teaching programs, things like that. Look and make sure that you're hiring or you're purchasing or you're using somebody with the proper quality and the proper education and training that they're going to give you.
Yeah, don't get the $8 knife.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't buy the $8 knife. No. buy the Microtech.
Yeah, I think Chris and Doug have kind of hit everything on the head. I think we've seen over the years you can just go to conferences now and see the difference from 5 years ago to now when we're talking about wellness conferences. They've gotten smaller. They've dwindled a little bit. I think some of the boom that happened and people getting into the industry, the first responder mental health industry, they got into it for maybe they got into it for the right reasons. I don't mean to say that I know that they didn't, but that they got into it and have fallen by the wayside for whatever reason. We also have those that we know did get into it for the greedy reason. Yeah, we've seen a shrinkage, if you will, of just that type of stuff. So, there's people like there's organizations like Survive First that you can go to that we meticulously, is that the right word, vet resources that we associate with. So if we're sending you somewhere, it's because we trust them, we've touched them. We know what they do and we trust that. So and if we haven't touched them, we'll be very, very honest about that. Hey, we've heard of that place, but we can't give you anything more. We just don't know enough about it. So we just won't say too much about that kind of thing. So the boom was there. The boom is I think it's on the downside, if you will. That's just, from my friendly observations, my humble observations. We're so fortunate to travel around the country and see different resources and different conferences, and you can see the difference. Even at the bigger conferences that we would go to 4 or 5 years ago, and looking at the conference now, you can see the difference. And the amount of people there. We're under that. So I think the people, those that have fallen by the wayside, I think now what you're getting is hopefully the people that are in it for the long haul. And now, like Doug said, you got to go ahead and be picky about what you want. You need to do your own research. There are many, many resources out there that do a great job. I look at it as a car, though, so if you can, what's the word I'm trying to, if many of them do decent work, and so I can buy a Yugo and it's going to get me from point A to point B just fine. I'm telling you that there's resources out there like a Mercedes that'll get you from point A to point B, and it's a better ride in the middle. More comfortable ride, and you're not paying more money, but you got to do the research and find out, right. So the resources are out there, and if I'm gonna pump one up, pump a few up, you've got Chris, and I'll let him talk about what he does in the Oklahoman organization he's with. Survive First is if one call this week, we'll tell you what we know. And we have a network around the country. After Action, call us. We do work around the country. Lighthouse Health and Wellness, call us. We do work around the country. Chris, jump in there. And that's just...
Well, I was going to say, it's, especially in Oklahoma, had the oil boom and then it kind of tailed off. Same way in the mental health, like I said, there was the boom, and it's not that it's a bust, But you can see the boom level is leveling off. So I always look at the ones that were there before the boom, and they're still around after the boom. Those are the ones that, you know, I think more so are in it for the right reason. And it is, like they said, it's about vetting them. The Oklahoma First Responders Wellness Division, that's what we do. Me and Danny have been around and vetted a few facilities, and just like Raul said, we'll say these are ones, you know, I would trust them. I would go to them. If we haven't vetted them, that's what we'll tell them. And so I'm like, I like the ones that were there before, and there were ones that were there before, you know, they were country before country was cool, or however that song goes, you know? So they were doing this work long before the boom. And then now that it's kind of, and you've seen some of these organizations, these facilities have removed their first responder program, or have removed, you know, they still got their mental health facility, but now they've removed their, because they've about ran the gamut. They've about made all they can make off that. So, you know, that's what I say. It's there's so many resources out there. It is like buying a car, or, you mean, you just have to, you have to vet them and make sure that's the one that fits you. You know, they're all going to tell you they're a fit for you, but you got to make sure they fit you.
Absolutely. Well, I'll get you guys after we hang up to send me, you know, links to any of the organizations, obviously, you know, Survive First and all the ones that you've mentioned, and I'll put them on the show notes as well. But I want to be mindful of your time. I'm sure, you know, it's evening for everyone listening, for all of us recording. So I know we've got families and places to go now. So I want to thank all of you, firstly, for the initial conversation that we did independently, but this has been so, so, you know, powerful to get all these perspectives, because you guys have been in this space for so long after your career, and talk about some of the things that we have. I know it's going to help the people listening, and I know some of the resources we're going to list are going to help them from here on in. So I want to thank all three of you for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you.
I'm honored.
Thank you, James.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you, James. Thank you, man. It's good to see you. It's good to talk to you, as always. And keep up the good work.
Definitely.
You've been doing some great work for a long time, and you've been helping a lot of people. And I will tell you, the three of us are honored to know you. That's for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's why I always tell people, when I always talk about your podcast, probably should be compensated for the work I do for you, but no, I'm just kidding. But what I tell people is, what I like, it's not just all first responder mental health, man. It's how sleep hygiene ties into, you have so, you run the gamut of every aspect of, it may not always be first responder specific, but it always finds its way to tie in somehow. And so that's what I appreciate about your podcast.